Eye on the Arctic. Views from the North, I'm Elise Quinn. Well, Arctic news continued to dominate global headlines in 2015, in everything from business and climate to politics. And now that the year has drawn to a close, that means it's time for our Eye on the Arctic Year in Review series. Now, that's when we look back at the people and events that marked the year in Northern news, and we look at how they shaped or sometimes even changed our understanding and perceptions of the Arctic. And as our regular listeners are well aware by now, we do that by turning to our Eye on the Arctic bloggers around the globe. Now, you followed their analysis and opinion throughout the year, but this is when you get to hear from them directly about what they think mattered most in 2015. Today, we are checking in with Heather Exner-Perot. She's the managing editor of the Arctic Yearbook, and we reached her today in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan. Hello, hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm great. A lot to get into, but let's start off with the big picture. If you had to sum up Arctic news and events in 2015 in just one word, what would it be?
Exceptionalism. And I know that's a long, long word.
You're going to have to help me out with that one.
What it means to me is that, you know, there was so much happening geopolitically and with Russia, and people thought the Arctic would fall into kind of the European or the Ukraine or the Crimean kind of bogged down, Iran, all those kind of tension points with Russia. But the Arctic continues to be exceptional in international affairs. It's the states have compartmentalized. Cooperation continued, and kind of the worst case scenario that many people predicted did not happen. The Arctic remained, you know, a separate theater in international affairs.
And was that something that you saw throughout the year, or was there a turning point where we sort of saw that, okay, maybe this wasn't going to go in that direction?
No, for sure. I think the Arctic Council ministerial was very interesting in April, and Canada had the chair this year, and the Conservatives under Stephen Harper had what they called a principled stance, where amongst the eight Arctic states, they really were the outlier, where they really, you know, very, very disgruntled, and rightfully so, I think, in what Russia had done in Ukraine and Crimea, and broken international laws there, but willing, unlike all the others, to kind of let that sour relations in the Arctic to an extent politically. And so it did damage, and it did compromise a little bit to the ministerial, but not totally. Russia was still represented at the ministerial level, although the foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, chose not to attend. We still had a declaration. We still had lots of cooperation. So at the surface level, there was a little bit of tension, particularly around the ministerial, But in the real work, that continued. And since then, it's just kind of become exceptional. So I'll get on. So this leads us to the 2015 highlights there.
Yeah, and with this, I mean, what are your three most important stories? So not the ones that maybe sort of, if we just tallied up the headlines, you know, what would be the most written about, but just from your perspective, as someone who watches these issues so closely, what were the three most important stories or events for you?
Yeah, so again, the first one, I'll just touch on Russia again. We had in the summer in August, the Arctic Five states, the ones with kind of a literal coastline on the Arctic Ocean, agreed on a fishing moratorium. They call it something else, but essentially that's what it is, that they will not fish until there is an agreement in place. And there isn't any fishing right now, and there's not likely to be any fishing there for another, you know, 10 or 20 years, but fish stocks may move in at that point. So it's really precautionary. So environmentally good news, states cooperating with Russia, you know, when there was really no urgency about it, but just that willingness to cooperate. And related to that, in October, we had the Arctic Coast Guard Forum start up. So again, here's, you know, very really about safety and security of people and of the environment and stewardship. And the Arctic states found, and this was still under when the Conservatives were still in power, by the way, still found you know, it was worthwhile for them to cooperate closely on search and rescue. So really concrete examples of how the Arctic states have been cooperating, you know, regardless of what's happening broader globally. My next big story would for sure be Shell's, drilling and then pullout in Alaska.
Now, remind us a bit about some of the features of this year.
Right. So Shell has, you know, it bought leases, I think, about a decade ago in you know, it's north eastern part of Alaska, so right on top. So, you know, they had, they spent, I think, about $1 billion on the leases. So there was no doubt that they were going to drill and explore in that area. So they've been exploration drilling for a few years, have had a lot of hiccups, a lot of delays. You know, they're in there, then they were out. And really, from Shell's point of view, and I think from some of the Alaskan policymakers' point of view, have had just an unending series of hoops that the federal government has imposed on them to jump through. And when they go through one hoop, another one is put in place. And anyways, the shocker was that they did eventually pull out. So they got permission to explore, and then eventually they pulled out. They said they didn't find anything. As we all know, oil prices are so low. But there's also, you know, they're getting tremendously bad press, especially from the, you know, activism of Greenpeace on this issue. And I think for a number of factors, decided that they weren't going to pursue those parcels much longer this year anyways. Who knows what they'll do in the future.
And before we go on to your third one, I'm getting a bit of a sense of deja vu. If I remember correctly, when we did this series and we were speaking with you maybe 2 years ago, one of the items that you picked was the drilling off Greenland that hadn't worked after spending, you know, millions of dollars. Are we seeing a pattern here?
We are. I mean, this has cost Shell about $7 or $8 billion, and they don't have a penny back in investment. And this is, you know, from the big picture, this is about the commodity super cycle. And so we had this image of the Arctic as, you know, the next frontier, the gold rush, the race for resources during the commodity super boom. And that super boom has ended. And with it, you know, the Arctic is the most expensive place probably in the entire world to drill, to mine, to ship all these expensive and heavy resources out. And it's just not going to happen in the next couple of years. It looks very bearish for Arctic resource commodities. And in Nunavut, North West Territories, Yukon, they're all facing the same kind of crunch. Alaska for sure is facing this crunch, whether it's oil or minerals. And this Shell Arctic pull is really just, you know, another kind of stab in a casket. I don't know what the term is, but there's a real cooling effect. So on top of, you know, the prices of resources, which is the main driver, is the idea that people have that it's bad to develop resources in the Arctic. And I think this is very bad news for people in the Arctic and governments in the Arctic who need these resources and need these revenues and need these jobs. But there's this image now in the South that it's bad stewardship, it's poor corporate responsibility to have investments in the Arctic. And I think this is very detrimental to the people of the North.
And now, before we leave 2015, what was your third item that we should be paying attention to?
Yeah, this is a long-term trend, but I think it's the rise of the power and influence of subnational governments. So the Alaskas, Nunavuts, Greenlands, Laplands, Murmansk kind of the world. And this is really, when you were talking about human development or sustainable development, this is where that happens. This is where education, health policy, social welfare, transportation, infrastructure, that's actually where it happens, where it gets decided, where the money comes through. You know, it's not a regional governance kind of issue. It's not something for the Arctic Council to address directly. So what we've been talking about, it kind of without them, and this year, especially Alaska, and I think the U.S. Arctic Council chairmanship really spurred this along, Alaska really took a step up in wanting to become a player on the international stage in Arctic affairs, and they even passed their own house bill, Alaska's Arctic Policy, this year, to really address their role. We've also seen, related to that, the revival of the Northern Forum. It's been around since 1991. It's a collection of these subnational governments cooperating on issues, you know, of, you know, kind of cold weather, remote, sparsely populated kinds of issues. And you know, they really fell apart for a couple of years, but now we see in Lapland and Alaska interested again in joining it. Quebec has really been pushing its Plan Nord. It's been very active in the Arctic Circle. We saw the premier of Quebec come to the Arctic Circle in Reykjavik for the second time, the second year in a row. And, you know, closer to my home, we have the Pacific Northwest Economic Region. They have something called the Arctic Caucus, where we're starting to see Yukon, Northwest Territories, and Alaska start to work on ways where they can collaborate with each other, you know, very, very much externally from what the federal government is doing. So I think this is a very interesting long-term trend. I think it's a global trend, but I think we're seeing it very uniquely and very interestingly in the Arctic.
So we've touched on some of these big issues, but, you know, before we leave 2015, from your vantage point, what was the most undercovered northern story or issue of the year? Or maybe the part of this question that I like the least, you know, what did the media overlook or even just plain get wrong?
Yeah, well, they keep getting a lot of things wrong, if you ask me, especially with the Russia story. But the one thing that was, you know, was really a game changer, and hardly anyone covered it, was this adoption of the Polar Code. The International Maritime Organization finally adopted a mandatory Polar Code to cover the safety and environmental aspects of shipping in the Arctic. And the ice is still melting, so we're still seeing an increase in shipping, even though it was, you know, again, it was not a gold rush or a race for resources there. But it's still becoming more and more accessible in general every year. And this is really a regional legal framework that actually has some teeth, that actually has some impact, whereas a lot of what the Arctic Council has been doing has been very nominal or symbolic or aspirational. This Polar Code will really impact governance, the economics, and social aspects of using the Arctic Ocean and using those polar waters. So it's a huge story. It's the most important thing legally, institutionally, that happened to the Arctic since the Law of the Sea was signed in 1982, but no one talked about it.
And, you know, I realize you mentioned that, but I just wanted to touch on, you mentioned Russia again. This seems to be an issue that comes up, I think, probably every year that we've been doing this, in terms of, you know, misunderstandings around it. Could you just remind our listeners a little bit about what you mean in terms of getting things wrong in terms of Russia and the Arctic?
Well, it's the whole narrative around the Arctic, the way that it's been depicted in the mainstream media. I mean, you know, well-recognized, you know, The Guardian or the BBC or Newsweek or Time, they just stuck to the same narrative from a decade ago, and they have not evolved, and they just, you know, they just fill in the blanks, really, with these stories. So it's all about this gold rush, this rush for resources. We hear about the U.S. Geological Survey, how much oil and gas is in the Arctic, even though it's not accessible, even though it's super expensive, even though it's not profitable, not feasible in some cases. We hear about this, you know, how, you know, people are fighting over territory. There's no territory to fight over. We have had this year, Denmark last December, Russia, I think it was in August, submitted their claims for the Law of the Sea to the Continental Shelf Limits Commission. I mean, it's orderly. It's procedural. It's institutional. There's no race. There's no rush. People just can't wrap their heads around that.
It'll be interesting to see if next year this comes up yet again.
No, I'm sure it will.
And so now we're on to 2016. Give us a sense, what are you going to be watching for? What are some of the trends, people, or things we should be keeping an eye on in the new year?
Well, getting a little, a bit more on the local levels is really education in northern Canada is very interesting. Nunavut just had its first Education Act review, and it was, you know, it's controversial. So, you know, the education system there has not been successful. It's not graduating students. It's not getting them through, with credentials that they could, you know, use in post-secondary pursuits or employment. And so it's time for a review. And this review really looked at a shift, really looking at a shift of moving kind of from the decentralized, focus on cultural education, focus on language, and really wanting to move to what I would consider a more mainstream approach to primary school education, focusing on the scholastics, academic performance, more of a centralization of the procedures and the processes and the curriculum, and there's been some pushback. So this will be very interesting. I think this has impact on Indigenous education far beyond Nunavut. I think people will be watching what's happening in Nunavut, because it's that philosophical tension between, you know, how much the same and how much different should education systems be for Indigenous communities than it is in, you say, mainstream or traditional Canadian and other societies. So I think it's one to watch and to see how this plays out and what that tells us about the future of Indigenous education. And the second one related to education is universities. And I did write a blog on this that, my own personal opinion is that the resources are better spent on secondary education or brokering other programs and making it accessible beyond the territorial capitals. But just recently, UConn announced that it would change its name from UConn College to UConn University, and Nunavut is conducting a feasibility study on having an Inuit university. And it really, for me, remains to be seen, you know, is it feasible? How will they get the students? Where will they get the resources? And what will, you know, what will be the trade-off in order to do this? So I'm very interested in that.
And from what you've since you've been following this, what do you see sort of on the local level in UConn and Nunavut about the impetus of putting this kind of sort of energy behind these institutions with the name university?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a prestige thing, and it's often said, you know, that Canada is the only country that doesn't have a university, but it's not true that we don't have university education. So there's a certain prestige associated with having your own university. I'm sure, you know, it would attract a different, could attract a different kind of, you know, a creative class, or keep people, you know, try to prevent a brain drain. It's just more opportunities. But I, like I say, I'm convinced that education is a good idea. I'm not convinced that having, you know, the burden of university administration and accreditation is really what people are expecting. And so that's why I find it so interesting.
Do we know why in the Northwest Territories we don't see the same kind of discussion?
Well, if I were to say where should you have a university in the north, it would probably, for me, be Yellowknife. It makes the most sense. It's the biggest and it's the most central. And it has, you know, a more of a mix of Indigenous and non-Indigenous people than UConn does, but more of a population than Nunavut does. And yet that's the one that's not talking about it. And maybe it's just a more pragmatic government. And also, I mean, the economy there has been suffering again from this lack of mining. So maybe focus on more practical issues. But again, it's not to say that you don't have university education or you shouldn't have more university education. It's just a matter of how does that get accomplished? Does that require having your own university and board of governors and faculty council, or can it be done in other ways?
Well, Heather Exner-Perot, thank you so much for sharing your perspectives with us today.
Thank you very much.